So in some ways, this is a bit of an unusual talk. These are some of my reflections. This, of course, Saturday was the 20th anniversary of 9/11, this tragedy that hit our country. And hearing a lot of the discussion about it over the weekend, there are a couple things that struck me. One is hearing this phrase again and again, we will never forget. And of course, it's made ambiguous by the pronoun. If the we refers to the current generation, the people who actually lived through it and saw it, of course we'll never forget. Those images will be etched on our mind. But if the intended we is we Americans in perpetuity, it's a sadly naive statement. Human beings forget. That's who we are, you know. You know, consider how many Americans now have strong emotions about the War of 1812. The War of 1812, I mean, you know, it was a big deal at the time. But it long has passed into emotional irrelevance for most people. You know, I'm sure there's a scholar somewhere who's written a thesis on it and has very strong opinions on it. But, you know, for most people, it's not relevant anymore. And much in the same way, 200 years from now, 9/11 similarly will be not relevant anymore. It will be, you know, that thing that kids study in school and, oh, yeah, that it happened, you know, that sort of thing. And there's something vulnerable about looking at that, because, of course, it immediately calls to mind my own mortality. It immediately calls to mind the fact that all the stuff that I have strong opinions on, you know, things I love, things I hate, things that drive me crazy, you know, all of that, all those strong opinions will go away when I die, you know. And even the memory that I had strong opinions about those things will be gone by the time everyone who knows me has died. You know, and it is, it's a bit uncomfortable to bring up mortality that baldly, you know. Because it's a profound limitation to ego. Ego likes to think that it, you know, my importance is supreme, you know, and of course I'll be remembered and, you know, all this stuff. This is one of the many reasons that the wisdom traditions have made such a focus on confronting mortality, looking at mortality. You know, of course, in Buddhism, Prince Siddhartha's journey began with the experience of realizing death was in the world. You know, and as much as ego chafes against those very natural limits, how to say it? We don't find meaning in trying to make ourselves so important, so large that somehow we'll be remembered. You know, that's not primarily where meaning comes from. Meaning comes from how present are we, and how much do we love? And that brings me to another theme that I was noticing over the weekend. A number of people were talking about the period right after the tragedy, the weeks after the tragedy. And it really was this remarkable time in which so many people were cooperating, so many people were giving. People's boundaries were incredibly lowered, and people were cooperating with each other who normally wouldn't cooperate at all. And that magical time lasted for a few weeks. And even 20 years from now, people remember it incredibly fondly. Um, Well, what's really astonishing to me about that all the wisdom traditions tell us, and neurobiology also tells us, that being in connection, being in community, being in intimacy, that's our natural state. We're designed for that. And of course, we find that incredibly satisfying. And what was striking to me about these reflections was that it almost took a tragedy of that order to break through the American defenses so that for a few weeks, people were feeling that level of connection. And then it went away after a few weeks, you know? We live in a society that is, that has some powerful defenses against connection, powerful defenses against vulnerability, against intimacy. Now, of course, in most primitive societies, certainly humans before recorded history and humans early in historical times, all humans lived in groups. They lived in tribes, they lived in villages, later parishes. And of course, in that connection, there's profound intimacy. And everyone knows everyone else, and everyone is supporting everyone else. And there's good and bad that goes with that, but everyone was already in this place of tremendous connection. And one thing that's so odd about the time that we live in is how many people live primarily in disconnection. You know, just one person living alone, or two people living, you know, isolated from everyone else. We live in a time in which there's such a thing as a fear of intimacy. People not already in intimacy looking in from the outside and saying, you know, I'm not sure about that, you know. And so, of course, the deep question there is, what can we do? What does this imply for our spiritual work? And I think I'd say, you know, first of all, it's a fascinating question. As you move through the world, what invitation do you make? What invitation do you make toward community, toward connection? You know, what is the invitation that people receive from you, just from the way that you walk through the world? I'd say also that in order for me to be intimate with another, I have to be intimate with myself. And that intimacy is something that I almost can have to practice and cultivate with myself so that I'm ready to open up and share it with somebody else. And much in the same way, community. Now, community is a funny word. You know, we think of community, we think of it very much in terms of interpersonal terms, and certainly that's one kind of community. But Jung made very clear that, how can I say this? The Jungian sense of the psyche is the psyche is this rather large region, and there's this very small part of it called the ego, and that's the part that's under our conscious control, and that's the part we identify with. And everything else is other. And so we have this, as it were, this internal cast of characters, all these others, you know. And it's a wonderful, wonderful question. What is the nature of our inner community? You know? Do these characters get along? Do we get along with them? You know, can we converse civilly? You know, can we be polite? Can we politely disagree? You know, all that stuff. Because, of course, the more I can cultivate a kind of rich inner community, the more I'm ready to be open to and even create external community. And I really think some of the people who are the loneliest are loneliest not only because they're lacking external connection, but they're also feeling tremendous disconnection in their internal community. I'm not sure if this is making any sense. In some sense, one of the ideals for community is the Buddhist concept of the Sangha. And of course, very traditionally, the Sangha is one of the three jewels or one of the three refuges. You know, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. And there's a wonderful quote. This is from the Apada Sutta. The Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "This is half of the holy life, Lord. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie." Don't say that, Ananda. Don't say that. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole of the holy life. When a monk has admirable people as friends, companions, and comrades, he can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path. So this whole idea that it's one of the three, but in some sense, the most important of the three. And of course, we don't have formal, structured sanghas, here in secular Berkeley in the same way. But I think it really points to how much of a gift we give community when we're doing our own spiritual work. How much of a gift we give, how deeply we're able to listen, how deeply we're able to accept because we're doing our own spiritual work. It's so easy for any of us to think, I do meditation or I do whatever for me. Does my meditation practice belong to me or does it belong to the world? Does it belong to the community at large? So at this point, I'll share the quote sheet. First, I'll share it with the Zoomies. Quote sheet just appeared in the chat. So a few quotes from sacred texts, east and west at the top. Lao Tzu said, "The one who holds the great Tao will attract all things to her. They flock to her and receive no harm, for in her they find peace, security, and happiness." And just that powerful image of how magnetic someone is when they're holding that sacred energy. Then the quote from the Upada Sutta that I just read. Two from the New Testament in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus said, "Where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst of them." And so just this idea that people coming together create the sacred. He also said in the Gospel of John, "A new commandment I give you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, so you should love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, that you love each other." And really, I'll say, certainly the historical evidence is that that kind of love was characteristic not only of the disciples during Jesus' earthly ministry, but also the early Christian community. And really one of the things that was striking, both to Christian writers and other writers writing about the ancient Christian community, is how fervently they loved each other and how fervently they took care of each other. And so really they were in some ways known by the quality of their love. A Lakota proverb: with all things and in all things, we are relatives. I love that. You know, can you walk outside and look at the trees and the flowers and the birds and think of them as relatives and welcome them as relatives, you know? An African proverb: if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go with others. Americans like going fast, apparently. Rumi said, quite simply, we're made of love and made to love. And all of neurobiology is proving Rumi correct on that. Tagore said, love is the only reality, and it is not a mere sentiment. It is the ultimate truth that lies at the heart of creation. The great Catholic worker Dorothy Day says, we have all known long loneliness, and we have found that the answer is community. Thich Nhat Hanh said, a sangha is a community of friends practicing the Dharma together in order to bring about and maintain awareness. The essence of the sangha is awareness, understanding, acceptance, harmony, and love. When you do not see these in a community, is not a true sangha, and you should have the courage to say so. But when you find these elements are present in a community, you know that you have the happiness and fortune of being in a real sangha. That remarkable woman, Coretta Scott King, said, the greatness of a community is most accurately measured by the compassionate actions of its members. The Catholic mystic Henry Nouwen said, however, community is first of all quality of the heart. It grows from the spiritual knowledge that we are alive not for ourselves but for one another. Community is the fruit of our capacity to make the interests of others more important than our own. The question, therefore, is not how can we make community, but how can we develop and nurture giving hearts? Dr. Francis Vaughan said, as we become increasingly aware of our global independence as a species, we can also deepen awareness of our spiritual interconnectedness. We cannot live in total isolation. The cross-cultural communion of awakened souls may be a key to co-creating a sustaining future and living in harmony with the earth. And I love that quote, almost this idea of like an emerging worldwide sangha. The mystic David Spangler says, some people think they are in community, but they are only in proximity. True community requires commitment and openness. It is a willingness to extend yourself to encounter and know the other. Deepak Chopra said, remember, in our inmost being, we are all completely lovable because spirit is love. Beyond what anyone can make you think or feel about yourself, your unconditioned spirit stands alone, shining with a love nothing can tarnish. Barbara DeAngelis says, love's greatest gift is its ability to make everything it touches sacred. Love is a force more formidable than any other. It is invisible, cannot be seen or measured, yet it is powerful enough to transform you in a moment and offer you more joy than any material possession could. It makes all it touches sacred. Marion Williamson says quite simply, people crave comfort, people crave connection, people crave community. Sharon Salzberg says, we need to redefine community and find a variety of ways of coming together and helping each other. Adi Ashanti said, we are birthed into a sangha, a sacred community. It is called the world. And finally, this long one from Sebastian Junger. I know what coming back to America from a war zone is like because I've done it so many times. First, there's the kind of shock at the comfort and affluence we enjoy, But that is followed by the dismal realization that we live in a society that is basically at war with itself. People speak with incredible contempt about, depending on their views, the rich, the poor, the educated, the foreign-born, the president, or the entire U.S. government. It is a level of contempt that is usually reserved for enemies in wartime, except now that it is applied to our fellow citizens. Unlike criticism, contempt is particularly toxic because it assumes a moral superiority in the speaker. Contempt is often directed at people who have been excluded from a group or declared unworthy of its benefits. Contempt is often used by government to provide rhetorical cover for torture or abuse. Contempt is one of the four behaviors that statistically can predict divorce in married couples. People who speak with contempt for one another probably will not remain united for long.